enter. All right, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and this is the Grim Rant Show. It's just me this time, but I'm doing an article roundup because we didn't really do enough articles, I thought, last time. So I'm doing kind of a, well, maybe a roundup, follow-up, kind of something like that. I just want to give you guys a little bit more and take care of all the articles we've got. So we're going to go ahead and start with some articles probably way, way back. Because we've got a lot to cover that isn't necessarily new, but still worth talking about. So let me go on ahead and... Alright, here we go. Alright. So one I wanted to talk about, first and foremost... was from Bounding Into Comics. This is Gail Simone. Yes, the woman who fucking damn near destroyed Western comics. Now she's crying that the house is on fire. Well, yeah, it's been on fire for a while. But we didn't start the fire, right? No, I think you actually did. So, Gail Simone has top 5 pet peeves of comics. And, it's, apparently they offer a stern warning to a failing industry. We're past warnings by now, lady. Increasingly, the comic industry is seeing professionals, retailers, and fans grumble about the collapse of mainstream comics. From Mark Miller talking on Thinking Critical to IDW posting record losses, almost everyone has an opinion, including Gail Simone, who talked about her 5 biggest pet peeves of the industry in a Facebook group this week. Simone's critiques of the industries are pretty standard for what's been spoken of by creatives. Now, just a little addendum here. I do have the Gail Simone run of Red Sonja. We haven't really started getting hard on Red Sonja yet, so we're gonna, you know, it might be a while before we even get to something like that. You guys did like the Marvel stuff that I started with, so I might continue further, and eventually we might get to that Gail Simone run. I don't know if it's woke or feminist or whatever, but she did do several issues of it, and we'll have to go through those at one point, if we continue with Red Sonja. Now, let's take a look at what she said and break her points down. 1. Not making sure veteran pros have work if they want it. The comic industry is notorious for ageism being one of its worst problems. Even Grant Morrison has lamented that he's aged out of being able to write for mainstream comics in recent years. Mark Miller has also suggested in order to generate hype for storylines, bringing back seasoned veterans with followings is a crucial thing that Marvel and DC have to do. For now, veteran artists find better places in independent homes like Comicsgate than they do finding work for these publishers. 2. Not respecting the stories that came before. This is probably the most controversial of Simone's opinions listed, as it's been the reason so many have been canceled and labeled bigots by the extreme left in the industry. Yeah, it's kind of funny to even hear her say that, right? Much of the lack of respect for the characters comes from replacing characters with race and gender swap counterparts and forcing beloved characters to be mired with LGBTQ fetishes. These changes have ruined multiple characters, and reviewers such as Richard C. Meyer have come under savage attacks for stating much of this same point. 3. Not allowing the artist room to contribute. Increasingly, the big companies have been outsourcing their work to foreign studios on the art. This has trained writers to be very specific in what they want, because with English as a second language, they can't risk an artist taking liberties. When working with a competent artist who understands comics, however, this stylistic trend can bring a detriment, as a good artist can bring a lot to a comic script if allowed breathing room. Yes. Price point. Many comics on the shelves are now showing introductory prices of $4.99, $5.99, or even $7.99 in the case of Ultimate Invasion number 1. This increasingly makes it difficult for a reader to check something interesting out off the stands because it makes the amount more than an impulse buy. If anything, the number 1 issue should be discounted in order to try to get readers on for a story. Yes. Otherwise, why wouldn't they wait for a trade or go find a cheaper form of entertainment? Alterna Comics has done wonders in this regard by using newsprint to create cheap entry points for readers on their books like King Cryptid by Peter Cimetti. I am familiar with Alterna Comics. We've got some. If anybody requests Alterna, I can read some alternas sometime. Lack of distribution options. This point speaks to both the physical and digital media. For physical, comics have been relegated to local shops for years, making it a place where someone has to know they want comics to go. They used to be in places like grocery stores, gas stations, and places where people could simply find books. Online is no better, as Amazon offers about the only viable digital option off of the direct platforms of the companies themselves. Comic companies need to open up other avenues and stop being so myopic. Overall, Simone made good points with her pet peeves, and all of these could be thought of as warnings to the comic industry as a whole that they are in trouble and they need to up their game in several regards if they want to remain viable into the next decade and beyond. What do you think about Gail Simone's pet peeves list? Well, again, I think it's really good, if they follow it. The woke bullshit that they're making is not gonna make for good comics, I'm sorry. It just doesn't fucking work. And even when you try to do, it's not like you can't be progressive, because there's been some very progressive stories. Even in, classic X-Men, Chris Claremont shit had a lot of progressive stuff into it. Talking about slavery and, there was even a scene where they alluded to that, in the past. It's very interesting stuff. I think it was in the Dark Phoenix saga. But yeah, you can talk about that stuff. You just don't be, overly preachy. I don't even care if characters are gay. I just want more than... I want their personality to be more than, I'm gay. Okay, well, what can you do, Mr. Gay? That's what I'm thinking here. It's like, okay, you're gay. What is your superpower? What is your ability? Where did you come from? All that stuff that makes a good character. I don't care who you're bringing to bed with you as long as the fucking story's good. And there's no sense in making canon characters like Superman and Batman gay, because that doesn't make any sense. Also, it's a slap in the face of the creators who were straight and didn't want their character to be gay. That's like, Superman isn't gay. He loves Lois Lane or Wonder Woman in some, different comic arcs. So I don't know why in the world... And Batman's a playboy billionaire. He loves all kinds of women. So, I don't know. It's just him sitting next to a man at a table. It doesn't fit. It does not fit Bruce Wayne at all. It's just bizarre to me. All right. So, on to our next topic. This is an interesting article. From Freethink, watch how video games are approaching perfect photorealism. Platforms like Unreal Engine 5 are enabling independent developers to create hyper-realistic digital worlds. You can catch a glimpse of the hyper-realistic future of computer graphics in the latest update of Epic Games' Unreal Engine, one of the most widely used platforms for developing video games. Beyond the graphics, the increasing sophistication and ease of use offered by platforms like this are making it easier than ever for small game studios and independent filmmakers to create realistic digital worlds. What's new? Unreal Engine debuted in 98 with the video game Unreal. I have played a little bit of that. A first-person shooter that gave the industry groundbreaking visual effects, particularly through more detailed textures, smarter NPCs, and Unreal Script, a scripting language that allowed for more innovative game design and customization. Despite what it says on the box, this world isn't Unreal. It's hyper-real, the New York Times wrote in 98 shortly after the game's release. Everything you see in here has been sharpened. Now, I know, if you look at Unreal today in 1998, well, this doesn't look that great. Okay, in 1998, it was something fucking special. Seeing Mario run around in a circle on the Nintendo 64 was something fucking special. We'd never seen graphics like that before. It was amazing. It was an amazing time because games were going from the 2D format you see here to a full 3D worlds, which we now take largely for granted. Crystallized, heightened, torch flickers seem more flame-like than real fire. Water is more watery. Footsteps are crisper. Large exhaust fans are backlighted with just the right amount of dust in the room so the blades cast perfect cinematic shadows. Even today, Unreal's graphics look surprisingly good. Maybe. But in terms of photorealism, it's nothing compared to what later iterations of Unreal Engine produce, such as Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell, Chaos Theory, and the Unreal Engine 2, Batman Arkham Knight, the Unreal Engine 3, which I have not played Arkham Knight, and Observer, Unreal Engine 4. I recently played that, and it is remarkable. To name just a handful of the hundreds of games built using the engine. In April of 2022, Epic Games released Unreal Engine 5, an update that has enabled games to feature graphics so realistic that it can be hard to tell, immediately tell, rather, whether you're looking at a video game or real footage. Photorealism in computer graphics. One feature in UE5 that boosts the realism of graphics is Nanite, a system that allows games to showcase extremely high-fidelity visuals without suffering performance issues due to high computational costs. Now that is awesome, because optimization is the name of the game. I don't care how realistic you can make it, just make it so that my computer doesn't blow up when I'm trying to play it. On the smallest scale, each object you see in a video game or a computer-generated film is made up of tons of tiny triangles, ranging from few triangles to millions or even billions. The more detailed the object is, the more computing power is required to render it. To reduce the computational load, game developers have often turned to a strategy called level of detail, where multiple versions of the same object are created, each with varying levels of detail. As you move farther away from the object in a game world, the engine will show you less detailed versions of the object, optimizing performance without noticeably sacrificing visual quality. Nanite essentially automates this process. Instead of designers having to spend time creating and configuring multiple versions of the same object, the system dynamically adjusts the resolution of 3D models as you move through the game, presenting high-resolution details when close and simplifying objects as they move into the distance, all without requiring manual pre-configuration by the devs. To avoid wasting resources, the system only renders triangles in the player's visual field. But dynamically rendering high-fidelity objects is only part of the battle in achieving photorealism. Light must look natural, too. That's why UE5 uses a system called Lumen, whose primary function is to automatically calculate how light from a source like a sun or a lamp will naturally illuminate an environment in real time, a developing process that used to be manual and static. Another major innovation is more refined procedural content generation. Essentially, the game engine automatically populates a world with models or meshes based on the dev's selected parameters. Previously, if you wanted to build a game that took place in, say, a forest, you'd typically have to spend time manually designing each aspect of the environment. Trees, pathways, hills. Procedural content generation does this automatically, allowing game devs to create varied landscapes in a fraction of the time. This can save studios a ton of resources, especially if it turns out they need to make edits to a game level. The tool helps make editing more of a drag-and-drop process rather than starting from scratch. Procedural generation was first used in video games in 1984 with the space game Elite, though the technique has become much more sophisticated over the past decade. Leveling the playing field. Creating massive, photorealistic digital worlds was once only possible if you had the deep pockets and large teams of AAA game studios like EA and Ubisoft. But with the increasing sophistication and automation of platforms like, Unreal Engine, but you can say UE, it's becoming much easier for smaller teams to enter the ring. Games made by indie devs have been growing increasingly popular in recent years, becoming the only class of games to grow among American gamers from 2021 to 2022, according to a YouGov survey. Of course, indie games don't always aim to be photorealistic, obviously this one here. After all, it's still relatively resource-intensive to do so, and there are arguably more important aspects to a good video game: physics, level design, and of course, the story. The main advantage of modern game engines is not necessarily enhanced realism of the final product, but time saved. That applies to indie filmmakers too. Although computer-generated blockbusters like Avatar: Way of Water, which was produced on an estimated budget of about $400 million and included a mix of computer-generated imagery and human actors, will likely remain the gold standard for computer graphics and film for some time, you can find countless independent short films whose computer visuals would have been nearly impossible to achieve just a decade ago. Soon, the difference between the two may be hard to spot. So, That is very, very interesting. Okay. Let's see here. Ooh, this is a weird one. From Pioneer Works, The Great Psychedelic Experiment. Researchers mined an old drug forum and fed the entries to an AI. The result could augur a new class of psychedelic-based antidepressants. Wow. Okay, so they're doing some shit from Arrowwood. For those of you that don't know about Arrowwood, that's basically where people experiment with drugs. Not in, like, the way you think. Not like, oh, heroin. No, they're experimenting with all kinds of different substances and basically writing their experiences down in a journal so that others can kind of follow that. It's interesting, but it is incredibly dangerous. You have to want to be able to be... You have to want to be in an altered state, because that's exactly what you're going to be doing. You don't know what you're taking, and you're doing it, you know, for a scientific reason, so... It's not for everybody. Oh, okay, so the game footage right now is a Ninja Gaiden remake. It's not called Ninja Gaiden, but it is Ninja Gaiden. And it's quite good, except for the fact that, first of all, the game is on Itch, right? And you could buy it there. But, if you buy it there on Itch, it's kind of like a scam, because you only get the demo. You can't actually buy the game itself from nothing other than Steam. So even though they have a version you can buy on Itch, it's not the full game. So that kind of sucks, and the devs are real shit for doing that. It goes pretty far, this little demo. Or this, not demo, this is the full game. Yeah, I mean it. It gets pretty close. Remember, I used to own Ninja Gaiden, and I've played it probably more than most people have in their lifetime. And I do mean the first one. So, when I say it goes pretty far, I mean it goes pretty far. I think I got all the way to... Yeah, I think I got all the way to the final boss in this, so, yeah, you'll see. Well, no, I know where I got. I got to I think it was the dungeon area, where you fall down and go into that dungeon, and then, of course, you make your way back up to the final boss. I didn't get there. There was a crash in the game, and I didn't feel like going back through shit because, you know. By the way, I had to kind of cheat, because this game gets really hard. Harder than the original. Okay, anyway, back to the articles. If there's one quick truism about psychedelic drugs, it is that anyone who tries to write about them without first-hand experience is a fool and a fraud. Hunter S. Thompson. People have been doing psychedelics for at least 3,000 years. Wow. And yet our understanding of how these substances interact with our nervous systems is still in its infancy. Until recently, illegality hampered clinical research. Even now, as some psychedelics pass the threshold to decriminalization, large-scale trials remain few and far between, a problem for research into such a variable experience. That's not to mention the inherent contradiction of conducting clinical trials on any social or at least highly contextual drug. People usually trip in scenic environments with their friends. That's hard to replicate under scientific observation. The temperamental nature of psychedelics is essential to their appeal. Drug nerds, the true bearers of this occult knowledge, love to share their unique experiences with each other. To the researcher, the same variability represents a bottleneck, and a costly one. Venture capitalists are pouring millions of dollars into new psychedelic-based antidepressants that move beyond the classic SSRI model, but without a precise index of the neural processes at work, pharmaceutical patients are unlikely to be approved. Last year, however, A group of interdisciplinary researchers announced a simple but powerful workaround. Using AI and brain imaging, they found a way to draw directly from the experiences of some of the internet's chattiest psychonauts, potentially paving the way for a new class of hybrid drugs. People usually trip in scenic environments with their friends. It's hard to replicate under scientific observation. Let me see how long this is. Oh! Hold on, guys. This one's really, really, really long. Like, I like the idea of it, but I don't think it's something we need to go into. Okay, I think I'll just read this part of it. Alright. Samuel Friedman, a machine learning researcher at MIT, came to the psychedelic question via an enigmatic region of the central nervous system called the default mode network. Formerly known as the task negative network, the DMN is thought to govern some of our most introspective behaviors. Neuroimaging shows increased blood flow towards this area during daydreaming, reminiscing, wakeful rest, and the quiet contemplation of our lives and relationships. An overactive DMN is also associated with a range of mental health issues, particularly the obsessive pondering of one's unhappiness, known as rumination, a symptom of major depression. Psychedelic treatments have shown great promise in interrupting an overactive DMN, apparently correlating with the subsequent improvements to a patient's mental health. Hoping to illuminate these connections, Friedman organized a talk in 2019 with Danilo, I'm not even going to pronounce that guy's last name, of McGill University, who was working on a comprehensive mapping of the DMN, and his childhood friend, Dr. Galen Ballantyne, a SUNY psychologist, pursuing research into the therapeutic potential of hallucinogenic drugs. Over dinner afterwards, the three men lamented the minuscule sample sizes of most studies into psychedelic-assisted therapy. Drug trials of this sort have particularly stringent exclusion criteria, resulting in volunteer disqualification ranging from 90% to 96.3%. Notably, people already taking antidepressants aren't eligible. Bzdok, or whatever that guy's name is, wondered if there wasn't some pre-existing data set out there that couldn't be analyzed. That's when Ballantyne remembered the Arrowhead Center, a labyrinth online drug forum where thousands of people have been sharing their experiences with psychoactive substances for over two decades. This opening yielded an experiment combining all their specializations. In the following months, the team downloaded nearly 7,000 testimonials for 27 different psychedelics from Arrowhead's archives. They used AI to boil down commonly recounted experiences with a particular drug into their most essential expressive keywords. Bzdok's, or whatever that guy's name is, brain imaging maps subsequently connected these keywords to a particular psychedelic as well as a specific region of the nervous system. The fruit of this labor is trips in neurotransmitters, discovering principal patterns across, 6,850 hallucinogenic experiences, the largest ever study of the site of psychedelic influence on the brain. Published in March 2022, it's been hailed as a Rosetta Stone that translates symptoms to molecules. Along eight distinct axes, of psychedelic experience, it offers an expansive yet precise map of neurotransmitter-receptor combinations that need to be stimulated to induce a specific state of conscious experience. It also clarifies how the DMN ordinarily works to maintain a stable sense of self capable of withstanding the constant stimulation of being in the world, and how psychedelics might shape things up. So, kind of interesting, right? Okay, so next article. Michigan couple visits Portland on vacation, say they'll never come back. Portland, Oregon. The drive west was everything Adrian Hammerly and Eliora Going, I guess it's Going, had hoped it would be. The trip from Grand Rapids, Michigan to Portland, Oregon was a long one, 2,300 miles. But Adrian couldn't wait to introduce Eliora to Portland. After all, he'd lived there from 2017 to 2020. Along the way, they stopped in Wisconsin, South Dakota, and Wyoming. The sightseeing was picturesque. The anticipation for the City of Roses was building. Yeah, I mean, Adrian was talking it up. He was so excited to bring me. I was so excited to go, and I mean, we've had some people be like, oh yeah, there's a lot of homeless over there, so just be careful. And I was just like, oh yeah, we'll be fine, I'm not too worried, said Eliora. They'd heard about Portland's crime issues, but understood it's something all big cities are going through. The day after arriving at their downtown Portland hotel, though, their excitement turned upside down when they headed to their car to find some coffee. And when we got to the car, I looked down at the ground and I saw there was a bunch of glass and I was like, oh, weird. Okay. And I went to go open the door and saw that the window was smashed to pieces. And at that moment, I was like, oh my, someone just broke into our car, and I was looking around the car to see what was stolen, said Eliora. The thieves had taken a Nintendo Switch video game, but their camping gear was still there. Distressed by what had happened, they decided to park in a different garage on the top floor, figuring that would be safer. A few days later, they learned it wasn't. So as I'm coming through I'm coming from the elevator and walking through the door and whatnot, I noticed the film that we put over to cover the broken window initially was cut through, and then as I was walking around the vehicle, just about every single window was shattered besides the windshield and our stuff that was in the vehicle, from our coloring books and stuff like that and pens that are all just scattered all over the place and just about everything that we had in the vehicle, which is a little more than we had the first time we were broken into because we're about to leave. Just about everything was stolen, says Adrian. Two break-ins in a matter of days. The city they'd driven thousands of miles to see had turned scary. They say they got a little help from a parking garage employee. Yeah, he laughed in my face and said, this happens all the time, because of course it does. Come see the apocalypse now, don't wait. Come to Portland, you can see it firsthand. Can't wait for the collapse. Get yourself a taste of it early in Portland. And I was like, that does not make me feel very good at all about the situation, Eliora said. And just like that, their Portland bubble was popped. Their safety became paramount. But after a car got broken into the first time, we decided to go out and explore the city a bit, said Eliora. I can say that I was definitely a little more fearful of making sure that everything was good around us. Just because, you know, that, like, I don't know, I'm not gonna lie, I was kinda scared. And what had happened to the city that Adrian had remembered? I'm not really sure where it's gone. It's gotten so bad, but it's a lot different than what I'm used to. What I was used to, he said. And with Portland in the rearview mirror, they still had to drive back to Michigan with plastic film covering their windows the whole way. A 30-hour drive home with no windows, and at night it got really cold. And during the day, it got hot in most of the states on our way home, said Eliora. So we just weren't comfortable at all. I had to put on some clothes that we had from the hotels. I had to put those on the seats so that, you know, we weren't sitting on glass on accident. I did end up having a piece of glass in my foot the entire 30-hour drive home. Wow. KATU News reached out to Mayor Ted Wheeler's office to get their reaction to the couple's experience. This is an incredibly disheartening and frustrating situation, said Cody Bowman, communications director for the mayor. He went on to list several changes the city has implemented to improve downtown safety. For example, city council approved a $6 million contract for improved private security in parking garages, including 24-hour security for Portland's five downtown city parking garages. They also point to a recent public-private collaboration to fund additional security officers specifically to patrol the hotel district 7 days a week. Longer term, they're working to restaff the Portland Police Bureau, deploying officers where they'll have the most impact. The couple says overall it was a good vacation, experiencing places they'd never seen, but their days spent in Portland are not something they want to repeat. As part of the idea of us going out to Portland was to show her the city and all that jazz to potentially move back. That was kind of like the end goal of after all of this. I don't think I'll ever be back in Portland. Maybe to like the southern parts or like to Bend, Oregon, to kind of show the places that we didn't get to visit. But other than that, I don't think I'll ever visit Portland, Oregon again, said Adrian. Damn. Yep. Pretty fucked up situation.
Look.
Okay, so. Okay, autopsy found that Neuralink implant ruptured monkey's brain. And Neuralink really doesn't want you to see the photos. Wow. Okay. Kind of thinking twice about getting a Neuralink implant now, right guys? The behind the scenes details of Neuralink's grisly monkey experiments just keep getting worse. Now a follow-up investigation by Wired reveals that a Neuralink implant deformed and ruptured the brain of one female macaque after an experiment caused several severe cerebral swelling. Oof. The trials conducted at the California National Primate Research Center at UC Davis by Neuralink scientists had left a 7-year-old monkey with severe neurological defects. Oh man. After noting the severity of the brain swelling, the researchers realized that the primate was terminal. But instead of easing its suffering, the scientists overseeing the experiment insisted the monkey be kept alive another day. Its final 24 hours were torturous. Per documents obtained by Wired, the monkey seized and vomited, lost control of her right leg, and shook uncontrollably. It also appeared to have trouble breathing, scratching at its throat, and gasping for air. Oh my god! A post-mortem revealed the extent of the damage. Leaked adhesive from the implant had inflamed the part of the brain that secretes cerebrospinal fluid. The effects were so severe that the rear of the monkey's brain protruded from its skull. Though how the cavity was created is unclear. But as bad as all this sounds, we may still not even know the half of it, as the photos that document the trials are being kept secret, Wired adds. Ethics groups like the Physicians Committee, which sued UC Davis, have been pressing for the release of hundreds of photos documenting Neuralink's grisly brain implant experiments. As a public institution, the committee argues that UC Davis has an obligation to transparency. So far, this has been to no avail. Questions about whether animals should be made to suffer for research that could one day benefit humans often haunt biomedical research. It's a thorny issue, but it does sound as though UC Davis and Neuralink, like many of Musk's ventures, has pushed norms to the brink and leveraged aggressive tactics to keep the research quiet. For example, even though the brain rupturing incident with a macaque was acknowledged as a violation of the U.S. Animal Welfare Act by, federal regulators, Wired says that the CNPRC preempted being legally implicated by self-reporting the violation. If you want to split hairs, an anonymous former Neuralink employee told Wired, the implant itself did not cause death. We sacrificed her to end her suffering. This only scratches the surface of the legal tricks being used to withhold the potentially damning photos. We won't wade too far into the weeds here, but the most important argument used by UC Davis is that the public is simply unequipped to properly interpret the photographs. By extension, the institution claims that backlash caused by the content of the photos would not only endanger the scientists, but discourage them from taking such photos in the first place. But this issue is bigger than Musk Neuralink, UC Davis, or the CNPRC. They're undoubtedly not the only bodies out there conducting questionable tests on animals, and the Physicians Committee has vehemently argued that the public has a right to know the nature of any animal testing funded by taxpayers. This certainly doesn't exonerate Neuralink from wrongdoing, however, and its publicity, and that of its eccentric owner, quite rightly invites further scrutiny, its opponents argue. Disclosure of the footage is particularly important because Neuralink actively misleads the public about and downplays the gruesome nature of the experiments, an attorney representing the Physicians Committee in the lawsuit told Wired. Nevertheless, the negative press hasn't deterred Neuralink going ahead with human trials, though the outcome of the Physicians Committee lawsuit may cast a long shadow over those experiments. Oof. And our last article comes from Business Insider. The rise of AI girlfriends is making male loneliness worse and risks ruining a generation of men, a professor says. Oh, here we go with her. Liberty Vitert, a professor of the practice of data science. Yeah, should be called data silence. She doesn't want people to know the data. Because then she's, oh, we'll get to that. Anyway, Liberty Vitert, a professor of the practice of data science at Olin Business School, always asks her class of mainly 18-year-old students what social media apps they're using at the start of the year. She says the question helps her gauge what's popular with young people. So when one of her male students said he had an AI girlfriend, she was taken aback. What? Huh? What's wrong with the real woman? Okay. It surprised me that he came out and said it so openly, she told Insider. I think AI girlfriends have been around for a while, but they've become increasingly more mainstream, so people are willing to talk about them. AI virtual companions have been on the rise since the pandemic, but recent developments in generative AI have put them in the spotlight. Replica, a popular app that we won't talk about much, that provides AI-powered digital partners, has surged in popularity in recent years. The app hit more than 10 million users in 2022 after seeing a 35% increase during the global pandemic. In the last year, several Replica users have reported being in love, engaged in an exclusive relationship, or even married to their AI partners. In May, when Karen Marjorie created an AI version of herself, which was designated to be a virtual girlfriend, she was flooded with subscribers willing to pay to have a relationship with the bot. Within a week, she had 1,000 paying subscribers and a waitlist of more than 15,000 people. Damn! Vitert published her thoughts on the phenomenon in an op-ed that The Hill titled AI Girlfriends Are Ruining an Entire Generation of Men. The article theorized that the next step is an AI girlfriend that can meet all of your needs. I don't see the problem with that. Only women complain. I had a woman complain about that just today. He's like, oh, this shows that we failed as a species. It shows that you failed. If guys want an AI girlfriend, it shows that you failed. You're the failure here. It's not a virtual girlfriend. It's a girlfriend that, by definition, learns from you what you like and what you don't like, she said. The AI girlfriend never has a bad day. And I don't see a problem with that. So these men have these perfect relationships and never have to deal with the ups and downs of a real relationship. And your problem is, like, I'm not seeing the problem, folks. Are you seeing the problem? I'm not seeing the problem. Vitert says the very nature of an AI girlfriend risks men choosing the bots over a real relationship. Risks! It's already gonna happen. Man, this game is buggy as shit, isn't it? Here I am showing you this broken-ass Ninja Gaiden wannabe game. Okay. Which could eventually lead to more single men and affect birth rates in the U.S. Oh no! They won't have babies with the women that treat them like absolute fucking shit and tell them that men are useless and men aren't worth a damn and men suck and... How many more articles and videos and everything else do I have to fucking point out about the opinions of men from modern women? I mean, look, they did it to themselves. Honestly, if women weren't like that, they'd probably have men. But because women want to be like that, men found something else. These AI girlfriends are enabling... Oh, excuse me. She says, while virtual partners can be a form of companionship, Vitert says they can also isolate people. These AI girlfriends are enabling this silent epidemic of loneliness that we've seen amongst young men. I don't think they're lonely. Hey, fellas, you guys with an AI girlfriend or a doll or VR, AR, or both or all, are you lonely? Would you consider yourself lonely, men? Do you feel bad? Do you feel upset? Let me know. We got comments for a reason. Tell me, what do you think? Are you lonely? She said, pointing to the higher proportion of single men than women in the U.S. Well, women are always going to find something. There's always some simp out there, right? We see females always report having more close friends or having wider groups of friends, Viterbi said. They don't seem to be psychologically prey to this AI lifestyle as men, because they don't deal with women! Data from the Pew Research Center showed that in 2022, 34% of women under 30 reported themselves as being single, compared with 63% of men in the same age group. Men also report having fewer close friends than women, something that worsened during the pandemic. The prevalence of these AI girlfriends has increased so dramatically over the past couple of years, Viterbi said. They're also getting advanced quickly. We're going from AI girlfriends who text with to ones you can send pictures with. There's this very quick blend of the physical and the emotional.
Well, I mean, what can you say? It is what it is, lady. You did it. It's your fault.
And of course they go into Joaquin Phoenix, who plays the man that falls in love with the AI and her. Now, her eventually fell in love with like another AI, but I think that the systems that are created will probably not fall to that kind of glitch. I call that a glitch. And even if it did happen, it's something that they would patch and fix. It's like, hey, my girlfriend fell in love with this other AI. Oh, we'll fix that. You know, I mean, they're gonna fix that. They're gonna have a business model. They have a business model based on this already. Remember when I said you're gonna be paying to play? Well, some of you are like, Grim, I paid to play my doll. I paid to play my AI girlfriend. I mean, seriously, at this point, it is what it is, because it's less than I have to pay for alimony, and it's less than I have to pay for all the other things that happen. I just talked to a man that said, you know what? It said my wife stole $20,000 from me. So when you say you bought a doll for $1,700, he says, I think you're doing really damn well. I'm like, your wife stole $20,000 from you. And he's like, $17,000 ain't nothing compared to the $20,000 that I lost in marriage. There's probably men out there that can say they've lost more than that. $20,000, oh, that was just a start. There's men that have lost hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in marriage. So you know what? These guys, they're doing like the Japanese, and they're like, you know what? Fuck it. These women aren't going to be there for us. So we're just going to get these AI. We're not going to worry about losing our resources and dealing with bullshit and cheating and fuck shit. We're going to get AI. Everything's going to be alright, and we're going to fucking make it. Because that's what men do. They fucking persevere. They push on. They don't fucking worry about, there's lonely men. We'll fix it. Because there's a man that said, you know what, I'm lonely, let me fix this shit. And now he's like, look, I'm not lonely anymore. And the women are like, how dare you? Why am I lonely and you're not? Well, maybe because men fucking actually, I don't know, they think about these things. Why are those platforms just, I mean, they do float like that in the game, but it's just kind of weird. I mean, I'll give him, you know, the proper respect for actually trying to do this. Because everything is where it should be in the game. It's almost a one for one with the game, believe it or not. Well, I mean, there's a few things you notice that were added, like that helicopter bit and a couple things like that. But for the most part, a lot of the platforming is pretty legit to what you have in the game. Even some of the textures. And of course, I like the scenes. There wasn't actually scenes like this in the original Ninja Gaiden, so I gotta give him points for that. His head looks kinda weird. And he doesn't look anything like the character we just saw in the animation. Like, I will say that the original bosses looked a little bit more threatening. I mean, the background looks cool. But he doesn't look that threatening. Like, he doesn't look much stronger than the dudes you fought to get to him. Oh, man. By the way, they word for word did most of the story. Of course, there's Mr. Parker. Like, I remember this game quite a bit, guys. It's like a childhood favorite. Yep. They've changed the name from... They've changed the name from Hayabusa to Nimbokan, but it's literally the same game. He hasn't done the second one. Second one's a bitch, though. On the tablet it said, and then he gets killed. Wait a minute. No? Like, I'll give him props for redrawing a lot of the scenes. Yeah, it's a pretty decent little game. Alright, guys, so at any rate, I guess we're going to be done here with the Grim Articles show, but I wanted to give you guys a couple more articles because I don't think we did enough of them last time, and now we've got some more there, and definitely something for you to think about, right? With the whole AI girlfriends and women getting kind of upset, and the Unreal Engine 5, which is going to make things even more awesome. Oh yeah, we've got way more articles on AI coming up too. Don't worry. But at any rate, this will be the Grim Lord, and I'm out, and I'll see you next time on the Grim Rant Show. Enjoy the decline.